Coming up to the second part of my discussion interview on stage at Grey Fox with Ken Irwin about the founding of Rounder Records. I'm just fascinated by this whole thing, knowing Rounder from the day they came out and remembering that those were the labels. That was the label you could go to for great music, whether you knew it or not. That's the thing that was so interesting about Rounder Records to me, and I think other people too in the audience kind of reacted to that. If it had the Rounder name on it, you knew it was good music, whether you knew the music or not, which I think is a bold statement that a label carries with it, that kind of persuasive abilities. Thank you so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. You know Rounder Records. You probably know Ken Irwin. Ken, you've told me a story that's not in the book. That's one of my favorite stories about the good old anti-profit days where you were involved a car wash.
Yeah, we traveled in a VW bus for many, many years. And we were doing a series called The Early Days of Bluegrass, another high-profit project, where we went around the South and interviewed and collected photos of musicians who had recorded rare 78s and 45s from the mostly from the 50s and some from the 60s. And living in the VW bus, we didn't, just the three of us, didn't have to be particularly careful, but we sometimes went to people's houses to do interviews. We went to visit Whitey and Hogan, and it had been a pretty hot couple days, and we didn't feel we could go quite like that. So we went to one of the old car washes. It was probably a new one back then. And we stripped down to a bathing suit, and we pointed the hose at the VW bus, and then the water would come back like a shower. And so we soaked off and got back in the car and visited Whitey and Hogan. We were, you know, clean as could be. Yeah.
Anybody here ever done that before? Or has it ever crossed your mind?
Yeah. It'd be sort of hard with the car washes today.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I love that story. And yeah. It's just the tenacity of what you guys were doing and willingness. There's in the book, there's stories about hopping on a freight train.
Yeah,
which I think was a crazy thing to do. Maybe you think that in retrospect, too, because it just wasn't a very happy time. But those are things you did. And hitchhiking, there's stories about hitchhiking in here because you want to stay true to what you're doing. And some of the hitchhiking got a little dicey.
Yeah, a number of sessions in Nashville I actually hitchhiked down to from Boston. Got there on time somehow.
The description that you all gave of the hopping the freight train, you know, because it, let's do it where the old people did it or the old time people and just hop a freight train and it'll be great. I mostly remember reading in the book about that it was very unpleasant and hot, and I don't think Marianne liked it at all.
Yeah, we got off. We were told that the train was going to a different place, and we went from Denver to Salt Lake, and it's extremely hot, and we had a jar of peanut butter and a canteen, and when we got out, turned the peanut butter and it just all ran out. It was just totally melted. We were both extremely weak. The water was totally undrinkable. It was close to boiling. I think right after that, Marianne sent her hair dryer back.
It was just nonstop. However you had to get there, hitchhiking trains, you know, jumping in with other people in cars and going to, that's the thing, it was the constant pursuit of the sound that you were always looking for.
We panhandled our way into the Ryman to see the Opry and the old Opry. Panhandled our way in to see Flat and Scruggs in California. We joined I think seven of us drove down in a VW bug, not bus, bug, and down to the Newport Beach Rock Festival. And we joined about, I don't know, maybe 30 people and rushed the gate. It's hard, you know, a lot of things I probably wouldn't do now.
I hope not. I can't imagine seven adults in a Beetle bug. I can't.
Oh, because we were a couple, we got privileged, so she sat in my lap for whatever it was, 3 hours.
You know, even still, that's a lot of people to be in one of those little bugs. But you did it. When you say panhandle, can you flesh that out for me a little bit? What does panhandling mean? Because it has some connotations that might, you know.
Well, basically, Marion
make,
and I would
make
go
it
up
good.
To somebody
make it good.
And we'd do a version of Incy Wincy Spider. We never asked for money.
Is that true? Really?
That's really true. And one day, Marion got arrested for panhandling. And one of the other guys in this house we were living in, sort of a crash pad in San Francisco, had a motorcycle. And we drove down to try to bail her out. And she didn't give her right name. And so we had to describe her and finally bail her out with money we had gotten from panhandling.
What was the fine for Incy Wincy Spider in public?
We just, you know, needed the right lawyer.
So anyway, well, I hadn't heard that story either. There's so many things in the book that don't reflect everything that happened. And I wanted to take this opportunity, and you all can ask any questions. The book really follows a good format as to the progression. One of my favorite chapters is The Quiet Girls. It talks about the women that were involved into including Alison Krauss, which is another sea change for Rounder, I think. I'm not trying to skip ahead, but I thought that was a great chapter about the impact ultimately of Alison, but plus the fact that it increased audience and artists who were female.
So what part do you want
to talk about? The Quiet Girls. And Alison Krauss is being part of the Quiet Girls in the book.
I don't remember that.
Alison became signed by Rounder.
Yeah.
And she had a very tiny voice, and she was a great musician, so the first Rounder records were more instrumental. And she kind of discovered her voice, and she wound up singing more.
No, it was almost all vocal. I think there was one instrumental which she co-wrote with Tony Trischka.
Okay.
Who was on the session. I used to listen to all the demos on the roof of the over our garage, and I would get all prepared. I'd make some lemonade or just, you know, really cold water, and I'd sit there in shorts, and I had those three, I don't know what they're called, carbon forms, and you know, if we were going to reject someone, I'd just, you know, address it and put it in the envelope. And one day, and most of them were in bluegrass, I got this one from a group called Classified Grass, opened it, and it sounded fairly good, and I liked the songs. Then somehow I got to the fourth song, which is when Alison sang, because she was not the lead singer. She was the harmony singer and fiddle player. She was 13 at the time. So I contacted the mother one of the artists who acted as manager, and he gave me a reference for a guy named Dave Samuelson, who some of you may know, ran Puritan Records, put out those wonderful Kenny Baker and Josh Graves records. And I contacted him, and he said, she can be anybody that she wants. She can be Stefan Grappelli,
he likes to drop obscure references,
but he said, you know, he said she probably shouldn't have her sing very much. Here she's 13, you know, at the time. So fortunately I didn't listen. So I got her contact information and called her up. And she answered, and she was very, very mature. So I said, I'd like to hear some more music. And like within a week, I got another cassette with a whole bunch of songs, mostly written by John Pinnell, who wrote most of the songs on the first record, and quite a few others for her later on. And they were great. And about that time, I went to another local club in Cambridge, and I ran into the guy who was booking the Newport Folk Festival. And I said, oh, you know, we're going to be working with this, you know, this young fiddle player and singer. You should consider for Newport. And he said, well, we already are, because she won the Kentucky Fried Chicken contest, and we're going to book her. So I called up Alison. I said, I have two things to tell you. One, you're going to be invited to the Newport Folk Festival. And she said, what's that? So so about that, and then I said, and secondly, we'd like to do a record with you. And this is where one of the few places we differ. I swear she said, "Mommy, Mommy." And she said that she said, "Mother, Mother." But it was like the, you know, it was really different with, you know, this person who had been acting like an 18 or 19 year old. And all of a sudden, you know, the kid came out and it was a lovely time.
It must have been so much fun watching her develop and watching her just expand and expand and expand. And I know that when she started doing some things with Robert Plant and has done a new thing, I know that she was still pretty attached to Rounder being involved. And I think Robert Plant wrote the foreword to this book, if there's any Led Zeppelin people, because he also has appreciation for the label. Well, how do you go from hollering to Led Zeppelin in one lifetime of a business enterprise?
Well, we didn't go to Led Zeppelin. We went to...
I know, but it's part of that. I did.
Well, you know, Robert and Allison both went quite a ways toward the middle to be able to work together. So it's Allison stretched out and Robert stretched out. And Robert really reached out to Allison and helped her, not as much musically. I think he helped her musically because he hadn't really done any harmony singing. He was always a lead singer, and not only harmony singing, but singing under a woman is not, you know, the thing that most guys are used to. So, you know, Robert really worked very hard on this as well. But it was, you know, it was through Allison, and it was also other companies turned it down. They just, you know, didn't hear it. They just didn't see the possibility that this would work.
So how could a company that's got Robert Plant, who's pretty well known, even if I have to couch it in terms of Led Zeppelin, I have to do that, and Alison Krauss, who's very well known, I can't imagine that the two of them would be turned down by a record label. It's almost. If for nothing else, you got to take a shot on it because it's too much to walk away from. What their complaint was, what, that they didn't think anybody would listen to it, or that it would have no success, or what? Do you know?
I don't know, and I certainly wasn't going to suggest that they re-listen.
Thank you. That went exactly as we planned. So again, the book explains a lot. There's a lot more that's not in the book. I know that you've at least read the book because you told me that you read it a long time ago, and that's fine when it first came out. It's all about you and your friends. I've read the book and post. I stick post-its on everything, and I enjoyed the book. It's a well-written book, even if maybe the topic isn't. He's a very good writer. The author is just a good writer. If you take out all the content about being bluegrass, you're going to enjoy his style of writing, and also mixed in with that, he tells this incredible story of Ken Irwin and the Rounder days. I think there's nothing like it. The community effect that you all had, the idea, the purpose that you all had from diverse backgrounds to pursue this one thing, and you did it with no expectations except to have fun and enjoy it and see what came of it.
Yeah, my original goal, I don't think Marion and Bill have articulated one, but mine was to have a classic record. So that if people were thinking about best fiddle record or best banjo record or best guitar player, that we would have one. And we felt at the time that we achieved that on record 14, which was Don Stover, the great banjo player, and played with the Lilly Brothers for years and years and years, 20 years in Boston. And something that Steve and I mentioned offstage, probably at breakfast, was that one of the things that doesn't get mentioned is that Rounder, we really knew nothing about business. We learned about music, and we continue to learn about music every day. But we had a network of friends. There were people that approached us or that we reached out to. Alan Jabor at the Library of Congress, Charles Wolfe was teaching at ETSU, Ralph Rinsler at the Smithsonian, just all kinds of people who liked what we were doing and encouraged us. One person who's not known in our field is was a guy named Archie Green, who was largely responsible for getting the folk music archives at the Library of Congress set up. And he told us right at the beginning, if you're going to do something alternative, you have to do it at least as well, if not better, than everybody else. And that was one of those things that really stuck. I was telling Steve this morning about a friend now, who's been a friend for a long time, who called up. We did a Brother Oswald record, which we loved, and we wanted to do a second one, and we sent the money down to the producer, and we didn't hear anything. And finally, we got a tape. It must have been months later, and we listened to it, and we're just aghast. It was like one of the worst mixed records we'd ever heard. And Oswald's such a sweet guy. We just didn't know how to deal with it. And while we're trying to figure out how to deal with this, we get a phone call, and this guy calls up and says, "Hi, I'm Dr. William O.T. Smith from Nashville, Tennessee. And how could you do this to Oswald? He is such a nice guy." And my phone, you know, my arm kept reaching out, getting further. Marion and Bill could hear every word. And finally, things calmed down. We figured out what happened. The guy who was going to produce it stuck the money in his pocket and recorded on a two-track. And once we figured that out, the same phone call, this guy who we thought was a raving maniac, I guess he thought we were, I don't know, but he said, you know, when you come down next to Nashville, why don't you stay with us? And I did for the next 40 years. And I'm still in touch. I don't get down to Nashville as much. But I mean, it's just, there are so many people like that. Who supported us, whether, you know, putting us up or just Walt Saunders, who we sometimes stayed with. Oh, good job, some Mountain Boys story there. Or suggesting artists. So Hazel Dickens and I were invited over to Walt and Ruby Saunders' house for dinner. And we came over, and they played us a little bit of some really rough Johnson Mountain Boys that somebody did. And at the end of the night, we did the usual hugs and ready to leave. And Walt's wife, Ruby, wouldn't let go. And she said, "You are coming to see the Johnson Mountain Boys on Sunday, aren't you?" And he said, "I guess so." So we went to this place, the Ruby's, I don't know, somewhere in Maryland. And we got there, it was like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd say 3/4 of the women on the dance floor had rollers in their hair. I mean, this was serious hillbilly. I mean, really, really. But the Johnson Mountain Boys were incredible. They did 3 sets. And, you know, I knew after like 4 or 5 songs we wanted to work with them.
In the book, it chronicles, and I'll try to wrap up here quickly. Really, if you have any questions, but I just want to do this. In the book, it talks about kind of like a yearly or every 3 or 4 years, the number of releases from Grounder. By the time the book ends, I think this is accurate, 4,000 albums, 56 Grammys.
Pretty close on both. Pretty close.
Yeah. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, there were a couple years that we did over 100 releases, but some of those were catalog from, I don't know if people are familiar with Alan Lomax, but we put out a lot of Alan Lomax's tapes, and that they didn't require the same kind of promotion.
Yes, sir.
Where do you like to go for live music in the Northeast now that would have the kind of emerging artists you might record?
Wow. Well, my wife and I are part of a series that goes on in Newburyport, Massachusetts. We do 5 or 6 shows a year. We still go from time to time to Club Passim, more for, you know, folk and gage, just, you know, great booking, lovely people. You know, festivals. We, you know, we go here and we go to Podunk. We go to, yeah, Podunk is nice because I think they don't repeat. It's like every 5 years or something like that. So they're always bringing in new people. Thomas Point Beach, Jenny Brook up in Vermont. So those are wherever you went. Those are the ones that that I tend to go to. But we do go to other clubs. And, you know, when we hear about somebody, and that's a question that didn't get asked, but I'll answer it anyway.
Sure.
And that is, how do we hear about groups? It's from friends, DJs, managers, people at festivals, you know, just about every which way. A lot of times from artists, you know, will tell us about another artist that they've known about or worked with. So,
do you mind, Ken, if I ask? You have a new label existence. It's very, very new. We're here to talk about Rounder, but I do want people to know that the group is alive and well.
Yep.
And that you're getting records out and recording things down the road.
Yep.
And I don't want to detract from the importance of Rounder, but I do think that we can look for great things from that group on that label. I've already seen 3 or 4 of them. It's fantastic. So,
yep. So my two partners at Rounder and our longtime president, John Verrant, who we often referred to as the fourth Rounder, started a new label. It's called Down the Road. The song Down the Road was on the first bluegrass album that I had. We're sort of looking down the road in the future, but also we've been down the road. And so we're starting out. We're in the early stages. Everybody's friendly, and we had a visit from the new president a couple of weeks ago. It was very nice.
Yes, sir.
I'm wondering. I was introduced to bluegrass listening to WAMU out of American University in DC, and there was a DJ. One of their DJs did a commute time bluegrass show called Bluegrass Country, and his name was Ray Davis. He used to do a lot of recordings at his home. He was very good friends with, for example,
tapes.
With the Stanley Brothers.
Yeah.
I was at his wedding where Ralph Stanley was the best man at the Fire Hall in Arcadia, Maryland. I guess that's been 35 years ago. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you know whatever happened to all his basement tapes, because I think that's got to be a treasure trove. And I've asked people about it, and they kind of shrug. And
I don't remember. I think they were sold. Don't know if they went to the Smithsonian. We'd have to. You could probably Google it.
Yeah, I've tried that with no luck, though. So I thought maybe you would know.
If you write to me, I'll find it.
Okay, thanks.
I can actually tell you about some of those basement tapes. His wife sells some CDs of those, and she actually advertises on eBay. You just type in Ray Davis on eBay, and she has quite a few of those basement tapes. For probably best part of a dozen anyway.
Her name is Nona.
Yeah, Nona. Yeah, you go on eBay. She wrote me a beautiful letter. I bought a bunch of them, and she wrote me a beautiful letter along with it.
Thank you so much. Thank all of you for dropping by. We're about finished. We're done. So he says, make us leave. That's what I just said. So Ken Irwin, I value you so much as a friend, and this is an amazing, amazing story of Rounder Records. And Ken Irwin, he's still the same. The book, Oh Didn't They Ramble, Rounder Records and the Transformation of American Roots Music, David Menconi. I recommend it. There are, half a dozen books here available.
And there are copies up on
up
top.
Up at the thing, too. So thank you so much for attending. I hope you learned something. I had fun. I always like talking to Ken. It's like one continued conversation over the years. So
just different with a microphone. Different,
yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you. And for your support of bluegrass.
Yeah, keep giving him a hand. That's Ken Irwin and Steve Martin.
Thank you, Ken Irwin, for sitting again with me and talking about Rounder and the record business and the music world, of which he plays in all of those. And thanks so much for the great staff at Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival for making such a clean, pristine copy of that conversation. With a lot, there was a generator right to my right. I could have spit on it when I was younger. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass.